Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Now streaming on Paramount Plus.
You ready, Bob?
Well, all right.
Audiences are raving. Bob Marley is electrifying. It's the feel-good movie of the year.
You dig?
Bob Marley, One Love. Rated PG-13. Now streaming on Paramount Plus.
New CBS Sunday.
You collect rewards, right?
This is how I make my living.
When something is lost,
everyone's looking for something.
He finds it.
You strong swimmer?
So-so.
So-so. So-so's okay.
Justin Hartley stars.
How you survive, you make quick, smart decisions, and you never let panic take the wheel.
Sounds cool.
It is cool, actually. Very cool.
Tracker. New Sunday on CBS and streaming on Paramount Plus.
Welcome in to the Husker 24/7 podcast. I'm Michael Bruntz. Brian Christofferson joins me for a little walk through off-season football topics. We'll reset the deck a little bit on Nebraska's the offensive side of the ball, kind of half of the offensive side of the ball. We've been running through that on the site, just kind of taking a little bit of a stock of where things are at heading into spring ball, which is still about a month away, which is kind of crazy to say, but we'll talk quarterbacks, running backs, wide receivers, maybe a little tight end talk if we're feeling wild. Okay. And then after that, new recruiting calendar suggestions, considerations from the NCAA. Have you read through what they are yet? Or are we gonna break that seal for the first time on the recording here?
No, I mean, I know the basics. I know the suggestion is June, basically to have three of them, June, December, yeah. February. Yeah.
We should just have a monthly one. If you want to sign on the first of the month, that's when you can do it. But we'll get into that in the second segment and a little Husker baseball talk. So I've rambled. Brian, how you doing?
Not too bad. I like your Orioles cap. You're a big O's fan.
Lifelong Orioles fan, it's good to be feeling good in spring training. That's what I can say. So,
are you going to move to the O's now? I mean, you were kind of thinking, no, you're not.
No, I just like the hat. I like the tricolor hat, mm-hmm. and it's popular with the kids because it's got a bird on the top of it versus the A, which feels a little too academic sometimes, I think, but that's kind of the reason for the hat. So. I don't know.
Yeah.
We're just trying things out. It's the spring.
You look like a young Earl Weaver. Ready to go like kick dirt on an umpire.
Earl Weaver is one of those people that I'm pretty sure was never young. Like he was always just like 60 and grizzled.
Yeah, like Sparky Anderson is the most amazing example of that. When the Reds were really humming, he was like my age right now.
Yeah.
Like he was like about early 40s and he looked like he was like, you know, your grandpa.
Yeah. There were a lot of managers in the 90s. Jim Leland was like in his early 40s whenever they had the Pirates humming along, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm pretty sure he'd been like chain smoking since he was in preschool.
What was the name of the Marlins manager the year they won it? Was it Jack McKeon?
Yeah. Yeah, he was like 90.
I was at a spring training game like the year after they won it in the front row, and I was with some people from work, and we were in our 20s, and we were there talking too loud about how one of the young ladies should like hit on him or something, and he overheard the conversation of us like setting it up, and he walks over and he in this like great voice, he's like, "I'm too old for you, sweetheart." So I think a lot of Jack McKeon. And what he got done only because of that story.
The one of the great mile markers, I think, in a sports fan's life is like when you start to become the age of certain coaches. Like, and I feel that more now. Like, major league managers always felt so old. Like, mm-hmm. or like your grandpa, they, you know, been basically playing baseball since World War II. And I mean, now like Rocco Baldelli, how old is he? Like, he's in his like mid 30s, isn't he?
He's a couple years younger than I am. Yeah. Like, it stinks.
Former Giants manager Gabe Kapler looks like he's got style and you know, definitely looks like a normal person. And
it's kind of it's our society in general. We don't want to like grow old now anymore. But I think they used to accept it better.
Yeah. Well, it's I don't like it. I don't like it.
There used to be pitchers who like Charlie Liebrand or somebody when I was a kid who you assumed were like 38 years old at the time, and they were like 25. You know, like they were, but they'd probably been married for like 6 years and all that back then, and you know, different time.
Yeah, Bert Blylevin's been about 45 for about 30 years, I think.
So. Yeah. Good anyway. Banter.
That's your old guy baseball manager talk, I guess, for the morning. Should we talk offense? I've been going through this off-season exercise, I guess, of kind of taking a look at kind of once the smoke is cleared from the off-season, what each position group looks like going into the spring. And I just because my little pea brain functions this way, I always like being able to just kind of you when you're able to picture like newcomers together in the same list with guys who are coming back, which I suppose is kind of what a roster is. It just kind of helps you at least kind of see like, okay, this could potentially be a position of strength, or maybe there's more depth here than I thought, or maybe there's a little bit more cause for concern here than what I expected. Quarterback, I don't know that there's a ton that needs to be discussed there. I feel like we're going to just beat the ever-living heck out of the quarterback position for the next 8 months. And I think you kind of know the cast of characters there.
Mm-hmm.
But the running back spot, to me, where does that fall on your list of concerns going into the spring? Of like, this position group, they've got to get some things figured out. Where does it rank? Is it keeping you up at night? Are you chewing the nails a little bit about the running back spot? Where do you fall?
No, I think they're okay there, but I understand the question because it's Gabe and Ramir, you know, are not available this spring. They're injured, or they're rehabbing, I should say, from their fall injuries. And so you always wonder about that and how they come back and if they just, you know, can hit the ground on a sprint from kind of serious injuries, both of them, different kinds. What was Ramir's injury again? It was a
shoulder?
Yeah, seems all right. I'm pretty excited about Dowdell. I like the fact that they're just going to rack up reps like him and Emmett Johnson and Quinton Ives. And, you know, the staff has told us, you know, how much they really like Quinton and to not just forget about him. And so this is really a huge spring, I would think, for him to like kind of make a move because you know how it goes. Like if you're around at a certain position for a couple of years and you're not heard from, eventually you just keep recruiting over that. But Dante Dowdell, I'm really intrigued by because I think where he came from in Oregon was pretty stacked in the room. He was like the third or fourth guy. And if you go back to his career in Mississippi, his high school career, I've said this before, but I love the fact that he wasn't a guy where you look at his max prep stats or whatever, and it's like 902 yards, but it was more like 2100 or something like that with like a billion touchdowns. You know, like I love when guys just dominate in the high school ranks like you would think a D1 recruit should. And that's what he did. He's kind of a big back who, like, I think, likes the old school formations. They said one of the appeals to him, his dad said, was the Nebraska uses the fullback some. And so I think he's got a lot of promise. So if he takes off, and if Emmett Johnson continues to like show everybody like, hey, you really should pay attention to me, I've got game, then I think we're feeling okay, you know, walking out of the spring. But those two guys especially have to prove it. And then if Quinton is like somebody of note, that's like extra on top to me.
What does the Nebraska's non-quarterback run offense have to look like to you in order to feel like they've taken a step forward in 2024? Because I ask this, I guess, you know, Heinrich Harburg led the team in rushing last year. Anthony Grant was right there. You know, with the injuries and everything, it was pretty dispersed in terms of carries and yards and whatnot. But what does progress look like to you?
I can't easily define it by, like, I don't think numbers on the season. What I could say is, and I think people will get this, it's seeing a higher consistency of runs where you're like, that wasn't necessarily that well blocked. Like, that should have been a 1 or 2 yard gain, and it ended up a 4 or 5 yard gain. And I just think it's been a while since we've seen a back around here. I almost think it's been since Amir, honestly, back to Amir and Rex era. Like, Divine Ozigbo had a nice season, and there was some nice stuff drawn up for him, and he got some things done. But like, I always use the game everybody can think of as an example. It's like 2014 Miami. Like, I remember I wrote a game story about Nebraska's offensive line and how well they played, and then I went back and watched it the next day, and they didn't play bad, but they weren't great. And it was like, man, Amir got like 120 of those 220 yards just by just great effort runs and just knowing how to play the position well and read the holes and stuff like that. And so I'm like looking for, I think, two backs at least who you feel that way about. Is this, you get in October and you're like, man, he's making the most out of that run like 80% of the time. There can be such a thing as a great 3 yard run, you know, where it's just like, that was a just excellent exhibition of how the position is supposed to be played. And that can sometimes be better than a 7 yard run, like actually where a guy turned what could have been a huge play into like, you know, only 6 or 7 yards. So, I think that's what I'm looking for. It's just those like extra 2 yards there. I mean, it kind of fits with what Rule's talking about with this team in general, like their theme and their video theme is like finding the 3 points, right? Or finding 4 points to change those close games. Some of that comes to these specific positions. It's like finding 1 extra yard on that play or 3 yards on that play. And so that's what I'm thinking about. Long answer.
No, it's a good answer. How much of that though, like, is just helped by having a quarterback that teams have to respect? Cause I was kind of going back in my head, like the number of times that Nebraska was having to run against like an 8 and a 9 man box last year.
Yep.
I think maybe that gets lost a little bit in the running back conversation of like, can I just get some help here? Cause I mean, no matter, you know, Amir Abdullah, you know, I think he still would have had a little bit of trouble last year, you know, against some of the defensive looks that Nebraska was facing. Cause just nobody was respecting anything that Nebraska was going to do through the air.
How dare you say that about Amir?
I think we're far enough removed that it's safe to say that.
No, I get what you're saying. I think it would help a ton if like the intermediate passing game, like especially like if you had to respect like, oh, Nebraska can get some stuff done on 8 to 15 yard throws down the field. It changes like the whole dynamic of how you have to scheme up your defense and think about the running game and all that. And you could make an argument. It's actually kind of an accomplishment. They had the yards per carry and stuff they did last season, given their just complete lack of danger that they could pose to teams throwing the ball and going downfield with it. So I'm totally with you on that.
In order to do that, you're going to need some wide receivers to guys coming in to be who you thought they or think they are going to be in Jamal Banks and Isaiah Nair. You need Coleman. You need Lloyd to take a step forward. You know, they were home run threats in very specific instances last year. But when I was kind of going through and doing the wide receiver stuff, which I posted this morning on the site, that group has a surprising amount of depth, I guess, that maybe I wasn't that hadn't clicked for me yet. And it seems like a group that I don't know that there's a group on the roster right now that I would say that has a higher potential ceiling than that group, just because of, I mean, part of that's from where they're starting from this year. But also just, I think they've done a good job of resetting the talent in that room. And it's a nice mix of veteran guys and some young guys that you probably feel okay about.
Yeah, this is a year you hope they take that step by the end of the fall where they're like, okay, we're done talking about this position group every offseason as like, okay, maybe it can happen now. And we're actually like looking at it like, okay, now it's just about guys who are coming back who already have a good resume. And now you got a wheel turning for the future where it's like, you know, the guys who are in their third year produce, and then there's a freshman who pops up and he's ready to take the reins from him, and that sort of pipeline at the position. Now the other side of that where people would be skeptical is receiver. To me is one of those positions I've done. This has happened with DBs before too. And on Husker teams I've covered where I've looked in the spring and I heard talked on air about them and said, oh, I think they've got a lot of bodies and it seems good. And then you actually get to the season and you're like, I was wrong on that, you know? And receiver, I've done that before, definitely, where you can talk yourself into like 9 or 10 names almost like in April. And then you look out there and there's a situation like in the fourth quarter of a game in October, November. And it's very real. I can picture these moments where it's like, man, there's only like one or two guys they can actually go to that you trust can deliver here. And I felt like last year, don't you think they were like down to 2 or 3 where you've really felt like knew what they could do? Like, yeah, I mean, you knew that like Jalen Lloyd could pop in and make a big play or something. But even Jalen said in his brief interviews, like he's got to learn more because he didn't actually play as many snaps as people might imagine. He just made a lot of the snaps he had.
Yeah. Yeah. No, he made them count. And yeah, it's interesting. I mean, going back to last year, I mean, by the time you got to, I mean, what, probably like the Purdue game, I mean, there was probably some serious question about, you know, whether or not you could trust a wide receiver to go in there and just beat a guy one-on-one, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, Lloyd and Coleman and those guys, they can run by a guy. But like you were talking with the intermediate passing game, I mean, could you trust a guy to go and get open on 3rd and 8 or whatever to move the sticks? And at least anecdotally, it seemed like Nebraska was able to scheme guys open. But if you just had to go in and just win a one-on-one, were they able to do that consistently enough? I don't know the answer to that. I would lean no, just based on kind of how things went. But, you know, I think that those guys, especially Coleman, especially Lloyd, will be better off in the long term for having gone through what they did last season. I mean, there's no replacing, you know, the experience that Coleman got with the number of snaps that he played. And you're right about Lloyd. I mean, I think he was like in the 120s or something like that in terms of the number of snaps he played a year ago. So, you know, I kind of go down the list in that group and I wanted to ask you, like, okay, who are, you know, it's kind of the spring football question. Okay, who are you going to be watching for in the spring? But who are two X factors in that group that if, like, they're kind of clicking, you're going to feel a lot better about that group? Obviously, you kind of go towards the grad transfers, but I think there's a few young guys you could throw in that list too.
I probably would say Jaden Doss, because I think the staff really liked him, and prior to that injury in August, he would have burned through his red shirt and played a lot. He's got that positionless a way about him, even when he was in high school, that like fits like how they talk as an offensive staff of what they want to be. So I think he's a good example. You know what? The name everybody's going to talk over is Alex Bullock, but he played like within the top three to five guys on offense most snaps last year. And people need to remember that was like his first year of playing like college, like football, really. And a guy like him didn't hit his ceiling. Like you need like guys like that to just maximize. Like maybe, I don't know, maybe he is like the fourth or fifth receiver this year, or he goes down. Maybe he's not. But whatever he is, you like need him to be the type of guy where it's like third and six, and like he's made a few of those catches from his first year, and he becomes one of those like, oh, he's dependable type guys. And like everybody sort of maxes out on what they can do there. He comes to my mind, and everybody will move past him, but I don't think they should, because they just look at the snap count last year and look at what his brother did on defense. That family's got it in the genes to do it on the football field. So I would say Doss, and then Jalen Lloyd, I think, though, being like a consistent guy who knows all the positions and can move around more and just rack up more snaps, I would say is another answer, because I think like his potential is so high and we saw a bit of it, but now like, let's see him on the field for like 40 to 50 snaps. What does that look like? Or if he can, you know, what can he produce with that?
Yeah. One guy that probably gets a little bit lost in that mix, we've talked about him on here a fair amount, Demetrius Bell. I'm just kind of curious to see what that looks like, because, you know, it was in November, Garrett McGuire said he basically came in the mid 150s and he's up to the low 190s now. You know, you had a year on the scout team of going against Tommy Hill and Quentin Newsome and those guys. And I mean, I think he probably would have factored last year in some way if he'd been able to play. And, you know, he's probably a guy that gets kind of washed over a little bit. And, you know, the other thing too, I mean, you've got a number of guys, a number of freshmen who are on campus now, Ja'Cory Barney, Davon Hall's on campus right now.
Yep.
Keelan Smith. You know, the wide receiver spot is one that's a little bit more difficult to play right away. And I think that kind of gets lost sometimes in terms of just projecting how quickly a guy can get on the field. But having an extra spring to learn the offense, having an extra spring to get used to the speed of competition and the reads and checks and everything that you have to be able to make, that puts those guys at a disadvantage to be able to potentially play early. And I think somebody from that group of freshmen is going to emerge and kind of has to a little bit. So those are kind of the two, I guess the young guys, and then Bell, and I'm eager to see what that looks like. And then in my mind, at least, you know, Jamal Banks needs to be the guy that you hoped he was. I mean, he's a guy that played almost 800 snaps last year at Wake Forest. He's been through it. Matt Rhule's talked about how he's been a leader already. And that all kind of signifies to me a guy that at least is doing the right things now to set himself up to potentially help in a big way in the fall. And that's, you know, that big-bodied wide receiver that you can just kind of throw the ball to and, you know, hopefully he makes a contested catch. Nebraska really hasn't had that in quite a while.
Yeah. Honestly, we ended up saying about every name, so that's always fun with these. It's like, I do this all the time.
Season, we have to.
Yeah, I know, but it's like when you're like, I'm going to make a list of like the five guys, that these five guys on this particular topic are going to do this thing, and there's like 18 names you end up with. Like, I squeeze them in, and I have like three names under one guy. I kind of, you know?
Yep.
So that's what ends up happening. But you bring up Banks. I kind of believe, I hate to say someone's an automatic, but I just kind of have a belief Banks is just going to be steady. Like, I almost like am counting on that. And the one where I think he, if he can find his stride that he had when he was at Wyoming, that can could completely change the picture is Nair. You know, if he had that injury at Texas, was pretty challenging, and really it kind of, it seemed like stopped whatever momentum he had there, and he wasn't heard from. But prior to that, he was like working with the first team at Texas and stuff like that. So you know, a guy like that, you wonder, if he can show that he was averaging like 18 yards a catch or something. It was ridiculous when he was at Wyoming. He was had a huge yards per catch. So if he takes off and is that sort of threat for Nebraska along with Banks, and then you've got young guys just feeding off of that, like that, then you really are cooking. So he might be the name I think of the most as I think of this offseason in that position.
I think that was everybody. I think we officially named everybody in the wide receiver group.
You know what else, though? We spent a little more time on receivers and running backs, and I'm not going to dwell on this, but I did have one more thought, and it was on Gabe Irvin. Because I was actually watching the painful replay of the Nebraska-Minnesota game.
Oh.
And
you okay?
Yeah, I'm all right. I mean, yeah, I forgot some parts of that game. But you might remember there was for a bit, it was feeling pretty good. Like in the second half, it's like, okay, this is the rule style. They're grinding it out. They were picking up the rushing yard. And Gabe had this run, you know, when they were backed up inside their 10, you can probably recall it, where he busted off and it's like a 35-yard type of run, you know, and he just runs over a guy and all that. And so I was like, okay, that was a really good run that I kind of forget about. And then I went back and I was actually watching some of the Colorado game. And again, yes, painful, but he had another run in that game where same sort of burst and ran through some people for a big run. And the big question with me is actually not, sometimes I know it's been said even on our podcast, you know, he maybe hasn't delivered to some expectations. I just think he hasn't been on the field with injury more than anything. And I actually think, like, if he's fully healthy, and that's the big if, but I think, like, he's got game. Like, I really do. I, like, see what, even in those brief glimpses, I'm like, I understand why the coaches like him and what that could look like as that guy builds up momentum into October and November and stuff like that. And so I just hope he gets a full run at it is my basic point. Like, I hope he gets like fully healthy and has that entire year where it's like, this is who Gabe Irvin is. And we actually get a reveal of what that looks like.
Because he's had the knee injury his first year.
Yeah.
Had pretty serious bout of turf toe, I think it was, his second year. And was still a little slow coming off the knee. Then was the last year, had the hip. I mean, he's never really, you're right, he's never really gotten a chance to really kind of go. Or really even have, I mean, I guess he kind of had a full off season last year. But even then, you know, that's been about it in terms of his longest string of health. Ramir Johnson's kind of the same way too. I mean, yep. He's never been, you know, in there for a full season without battling something.
Yeah. And I've always thought whenever Ramir touches the ball, usually it's positive, you know, it has worked out pretty well when he gets the ball. But yeah. And every coach that has had Gabe here at Nebraska, he's had a few different ones, has tended to like him and saw the what could be. So there's kind of been a common read from guys who are actually in the profession doing it every day that he's got the goods, but it's just a matter of having that healthy season. So I don't know. I just think the narrative should be more about it's the injury thing that stood in the way. It's not, I don't think it's the talent thing. I think it's there. It's just a matter of like, can we actually see it in full now and then what that looks like.
So he'll be out for spring. Ramir Johnson also out for spring. So we'll get maybe another look at that once we get to fall camp. Should we take a quick break, get your calendars out, and we can see, start planning signing days, apparently, or at least discuss planning signing days. We'll be right back.
Paramount Plus and the National Park Foundation present A Mountain of Zen. This Earth Week, you can live stream seven national parks for 7 days on Paramount Plus. Paramount Plus, official streaming partner of the National Park Foundation.
You can now relive the best moments of the UEFA Champions League 24/7. The UEFA Champions League channel is a new 24-hour streaming channel serving non-stop goals, highlights, and full match replays from the world's most prestigious club competition. Reminisce on your favorite moments, legendary players, and brilliant goals with the UEFA Champions League channel, streaming around the clock on Pluto TV and the CBS Sports app.
On May 23rd...
I want to go back to normal.
What's normal?
The Paramount Plus original series, Evil, returns.
We've already hunted werewolves and demons.
And now what? A baby Antichrist?
Okie dokie.
Prepare yourself.
You will not beat us.
For the end.
I have visions of hell.
Make it stop. Make it shut up.
You're not gonna survive this.
Evil, the final season. Streaming May 23rd. Only on Paramount Plus.
All right. So a little bit of somewhat breaking news this morning. It's been reported elsewhere, but Pete Thamel of ESPN, the recruiting calendar, which, I mean, it shouldn't be a surprise that it's being kind of reconsidered or, you know, they're looking at different options to make it a little less stressful in December for coaches. But here's what it looks like for those that have not not seen or heard. Potentially the first NLI signing period, a 3 or 7 calendar day period beginning the last Wednesday in June. You would have a second signing period beginning the Wednesday following the last FBS regular season game. And then the traditional first signing period, or first Wednesday in February signing period. So you would have 3 chances, I guess, for prospects to sign. This was coming for a while, I think. Mm-hmm. It feels like every couple of years the recruiting calendar gets reconfigured and things come out of that that maybe aren't expected. But at first glance, what do you make of those 3 days, Brian Christopherson?
I'm fine with it. And it sounds like something you can make fun of at first and just be like, oh, because this coach liked this idea, that coach liked that idea. Here, have all of them. It's sort of like us talking about all the guys on the in the receiver room. Let's cover it all. But I actually don't think it'll be as unwieldy as it like seems, because the February one, which has already become close to nothing some years, I think would remain that way. It would just sort of be for like those special scenarios and maybe where a coach left a program and you have those recruits who are available now to get out of their original signing. So I don't think that's a big deal. I think moving it up in December would probably be I think it would be heavily agreed on by coaches. I'm not positive, but that would be my guess, judging by their reaction to sort of what the calendar previously was. So I think moving it up in December is a good idea. And yeah, why not? I mean, we already know like 15 guys usually by the end of June that are in a class. And for the most part, I've noticed this around here, but maybe it's been different elsewhere, but we haven't seen as much flipping, I don't think, the last couple cycles either. Am I talking out of my backside or am I wrong? It doesn't feel like, I mean, there's been ones, a few, there's always going to be a few, but it doesn't feel like there's just been flips all over the place. So, I mean, guys usually are kind of settled in if they commit in the summer.
Yeah, no, I think if guys are committing in June or earlier, With rare exceptions, Kwon Lacy is the one that comes to mind.
Yeah,
this past time around, but for the most part, I mean those guys are locked in. You know, if you're committing earlier, you've probably had that offer for a while, or it's a more of a local offer. You've made your visits, and you felt comfortable to pull the trigger and kind of shut things down. I mean, you're right that in rare cases, have even those guys that, you know, committed early, rarely do they take more visits. I mean, it's just kind of done. And it kind of goes back to the old Bo Pelini idea of you just, mm-hmm. you sign when you sign and you're done. Like it's a little bit like the old, you know, we're going to sign the NLI here on the hood of the car once you're ready to go. But I mean, I don't mind. I think it makes sense to have one in the summer to take less to take pressure off of the one in December or November or what, you know, the end of fall one, because that's become, you know, the new national signing day versus whatever they have in February.
Bo kind of convinced me his idea was good back then, and I've thought about it more, and I don't love it now because I think like you'd get cases where you could have knee jerk reaction sometimes, where a kid really enjoyed a visit like in April or something and signs and maybe should wait it out a little bit. I'm trying to think if there's a negative to the June thing. I guess it could put some pressure on guys who want to commit and lock up their space, but they'd also like to take their officials in the fall and see like what that looks like at different places and have that experience and stuff. Where they'll feel like I better sign now. You know, otherwise am I going to lose this opportunity? I don't know. I'm thinking out loud, but I'm trying to think of like in the recruit shoes, if the June thing has any, negative effects. That's all I can come up with really is like, if there's that like pressure, like, cause in theory you could like commit, but say, I'm not going to sign yet, you know, in June, I'm going to wait, I'm going to go on my officials. But I am curious what the reaction will be to those prospects that do that, you know, because they'll be like, what, you're not ready to sign and all that stuff. But yeah, you know, your buddies are. So that could be interesting, maybe.
Yeah, it's the thing that I kind of, my immediate reaction was, okay, well, if a kid signs in late June, how do you handle things in November if a coach leaves, a coach is fired? You have a changeover in the program. I mean, as it is now, if you're on the roster, you get your 30-day window to enter the portal if a coach leaves or is fired. Are you immediately released from your letter of intent? You know, that's at least a consideration to me because there were, what, 30 jobs that came open?
So there's going to be freak shows from it still.
Yeah. Like I kind of wonder what that looks like then. Because I mean, if let's say it happens like that second signing day is in late November, a coach gets fired right after the regular season. Even if a kid's released, I mean, then you're kind of pushing everybody forward to February at that point, if they want to take visits elsewhere and you know, maybe end up at a different school. That was kind of my first thought was what does that kind of look like? I also wonder too, if, you know, you're getting guys to sign before their senior year at the end of June, how early are you making those offers and starting those relationships with prospects? Like, does that speed up the recruitment? Does it speed up, make offers earlier? I'm not naive. I know that programs are already offering fairly early now as it is, but do you see that more frequently outside of like just the surefire? These are, you know, high four-star, you know, blue chip type prospects, because those guys obviously are going to get attention early, but do you see more coaches making projections just because you have to, you know, get in the door a little bit sooner because the recruiting process is a little bit more sped up? I don't know.
It does open up some interesting strategy too. As far as like those schools that like, okay, here's basically our entire class in June. This is basically it. You'll get some of those with a, you know, one or two spaces open. And then there might be some programs where they're thinking like, no, we need to save like 5 to 7 spots at least to like evaluate some of the senior film. Some coaches who might go a little more old school with it and be like, okay, everybody's going to overplay their hand in June, you know, and have their class together, but there's going to be these good prospects who are developing at the age of 17 and their bodies are forming and they're putting up impressive stuff that are going to be there late too. Like, we're going to get, because we'll have the room for it. So it could open up. I mean, that some of that already exists because people are already like, they're not signed in June, like they're committed. These classes have like 20 commits in them by June, some of them and all that stuff. And So you already have some of that going on. But it will be interesting when it's so like finalized and people actually like 15 guys have actually signed, you know, in June, and like what that means to the whole thing. And you're right, there's going to be coaching changes. That's going to shake it up. I think the easiest one for me to get my head around that makes sense is moving it up in early December. Like that's the one where I don't have to think too long. And I think that's a good idea. The other ones I can go back and forth on a bit.
Yeah. I mean, December has just been a mess with the portal, with coaches basically crisscrossing the country with the high school stuff for the last 3 weeks of the month. Now you mix in, you know, the college football playoff being expanded. You have more games in December. I mean, at some point, the current roster and winning those football games has to matter, right? Like, and, mm-hmm. I think sometimes with the way that it is now, you know, with the older model, you're almost penalized a little bit by, you know, playing an early bowl game or being involved in the college football playoff, because you're having to be so focused on your own roster that you can't kind of compete with everybody else for prospects who are out there.
Yeah. Michigan was supposedly a player for like Jamal Banks at some point in that pursuit. And that was funny because I understand it. There wasn't really anything from their side about it because, oh yeah, they had a billion other things going on. I mean, we've around here, not a good thing, but maybe it was beneficial to the staff in this one case, if you wanted to play the pros and cons of not making a bowl game, that they actually had that time to, like, after their first year to sort of like, okay, let's look at this roster. What do we need portal wise, you know, and really put all their attention toward that, where some other people were distracted. But yeah, imagine what it'd be like if Nebraska were playing in a fairly big game in December. And you got all this commotion around it. The portal thing's still going to be a mess though, right? I mean, in December, certain programs are trying to get 10 to 12 guys out of the portal still, or yeah, more.
So other considerations that they have, there would potentially be a complete December dead period. They would also look at a December quiet period. And then one other consideration that's also being taken is you would potentially have more official visits, bumping that number up to 70. You would maybe even be able to start them a little bit earlier, I guess, than what they do currently. So lots to talk about. From what it says, it wouldn't go into effect until the following year. They wouldn't actually review the proposals until this June. So it's not like this is coming down the pike like in a couple months. But
so we can talk about it next year at this time.
Yeah.
On the podcast.
And it gives you time to plan some vacations too, because apparently now that last week in June is a no-go. So that's also a consideration as well. Anything else you got? Anything offhand on that?
No, that doesn't mean that's as much as I could talk about anything with the calendar that we did. I think we did as bang up a job as we could have, honestly.
All right. Should we finish with some baseball?
Yeah.
Not Earl Weaver talk.
Yeah, Husker baseball.
So Husker baseball comes back, or was in Arizona, playing Grand Canyon, the alma maters. We learned of Kevin Warren and Tim Salmon, a Grand Canyon guy. But Nebraska baseball comes back with a 3-1 record against a pretty good Grand Canyon team that will be in the NCAA tournament hunt at the end of the year. A little bit dicey on Sunday, gave up a 7-run lead, ended up winning 10-8. And won the first two games of the series pretty impressively behind really solid pitching performances from Drew Christo, and Brett Sears, both going six innings. So I think all things considered, the first two weekends, you have to feel okay about the way things are kind of trending for Nebraska, and especially given some of the injuries they've had, or not injuries, but guys not being available the first 2 weeks of the season.
Yeah, you might need to educate the general public a little bit on this. I don't know that. See, I wouldn't have understood, and I think a lot of people wouldn't have. Like, Grand Canyon winning 3 out of 4 was I mean, pretty doggone good, right? I mean, I think some people like, okay, I haven't heard much about them. You should win 3 out of 4, but that was an impressive series, wouldn't you say?
They will be, like I said, they'll be in the hunt for an NCAA tournament berth. I think it'll be a series that at the end of the year you look at as a net positive for RPI and perception. And especially, I think, coming off of the 1 and 2 weekend down in Texas 2 weekends ago, it was nice to kind of get a little get some win column stuff for the for the effort. And yeah, I mean, Grand Canyon's kind of a team that's always towards the front of the whack. They're going to be there at the end of the year, like I said. And Nebraska on Thursday night in the opener, they beat a guy that's one of the better pitchers on the West Coast. So kind of take all that together, and not a bad weekend. A weekend that was a little bit emotionally charged too. It felt like a late season conference weekend. Some chirping, some pointing. Guy got tossed for flipping his bat.
Yeah.
He had a little bit of everything.
Seemed like Grand Canyon had some hotheads and they got our boys riled up. No, I like to see it from Nebraska. Like, that's something, you know, a clubhouse, you got to have, I think, in baseball, pardon my language, I believe red ass is allowed, right?
We can say red ass.
Yeah. You got to have those in a clubhouse, or you're just not going to, the other side's going to have them and it's not going to end up well for you. And I think you saw some examples that maybe Nebraska's got a little bit more of that, built in that dugout than they maybe had the last year or so.
Yeah. So what happened? Nebraska taking the first two from Grand Canyon. The third game was a little tightly contested, and you could tell that Grand Canyon was trying to fire themselves up a little bit after the way the first two games had gone. One of Grand Canyon's relievers, or a couple of them actually, were getting a little bit effusive with their post-strikeout celebrations.
Mm-hmm.
Including one that took his hat off and was kind of gesturing at Nebraska. I believe it was Josh Karen, which kind of bled over into the post-game handshake line where the teams had to be separated. And on Sunday, a Grand Canyon hitter hits a grand slam to tie the game, takes his bat down towards first base, flips it, crosses home plate, and gets tossed for... Basically, I think he kind of paid the price for his teammates being a little bit too aggressive with celebrating on Saturday night. But to your point, it was good to see Nebraska kind of match their emotion on Sunday. And you know what? Will Bolt and his coaching staff had kind of said all fall that it was a really competitive group, to the point where guys are having to get separated at times during just not even games and scrimmages, but just like mundane competitive stuff in the clubhouse. And I think you need some of that to be able to win those games on Sunday when it's a little tough.
That's good. I mean, I love nothing more than a scene on a baseball game of a 5'9" guy in the dugout with a lot of eye black and a big wad of gum in his mouth, what have you. And he's like kind of on the top step, like chirp, you know, yelling back at the other side like that. I love that scene. I picture like Dustin Pedroia kind of doing it. He's like in my head, like doing it to the other side.
Yeah. So on Sunday you score the go ahead run on a pass ball and a steal of home. Nice. It was an emotional day, and you know, I think positive signs from Drew Christo. He was, you know, throwing mid-90s, mixing in a good slider, and you know, he threw six strong innings. I mean, if you can get six strong innings out of the gate from Christo and Sears at the top of that rotation, that bodes well for Nebraska when they get into Big Ten play.
Yeah, that's good. So what's next now?
They are in Charleston for another 4-game weekend. Charleston is 7-0, called Charleston 7-0. They don't typically lose at home. They got like they win about 75% of the games at home, playing good baseball now. Just something to watch as a last thing. You know, Nebraska's bullpen is much deeper this year. this past weekend, they didn't have Casey Dice or Kyle Frelick available. Those are two guys that are kind of back of the bullpen, eighth and ninth inning options. We'll see if they're available for this week. Getting them back would be huge with a four-game series, but that's just something to watch there. But that same rotation, and Nebraska's going to try to see if they can piece together a few wins down there too. This is another series that has the potential to be very valuable for postseason mm-hmm. RPI type stuff. At the
end has College of Charleston, forgive me for not knowing, have they been kind of a regular in the tournament?
I believe so.
But they're 7-0 now is the important thing. So they got something.
They've been hitting well. They pitch it pretty well. It's going to be – I would have probably said that Grand Canyon was going to be the tougher series. But, I mean, this is going to be a pretty tough one. They swept Marshall and they swept Youngstown State. So you would hope that Nebraska would be a little bit step up in competition from those two programs.
Good stuff happening right now. Like, it's an interesting time in Husker athletics. Baseball could be on the climb, we're hoping.
Yep.
Men's and women's basketball are going to make the dance, you hope. And then
playing for seeding now.
Yeah. Yep. Playing for a double bye. We have that podcast up too, so people can check that out.
Yeah, lots going on. Spring football, we'll still be reviewing things in the lead up to that. Might hear from Matt Rhule soon when that all goes down after the NCAA tournament gets rolling. But we'll have everything at Husker 24/7. Full coverage from baseball, basketball, continuing to discuss football. Lots of official visits being set right now for the summer, and you know, it looks like the red-white game is going to be a pretty big visit weekend. It always is, but even more so now because you're going to have official visitors in town that weekend. So get to Husker 24/7 for all of that and much, much more. We'll be back next week with two more podcasts.